Good evening, everybody. James McCanny here with My Science Hour. This is for February 1st, 2024. Why do I have 2025 written in my notes? I'm trying to jump a year ahead here, maybe to hopeful, wishful thinking, trying to eliminate this year before it starts. But just first of all, a fun fact here, and this is a one-hour show, commercial-free. And it's been in my 24th year doing this same time slot, same radio station, WWCR Nashville, Tennessee. But this is a 1 hour show. But in that 1 hour, by the time I get done with this show, provided that Planet X doesn't come and kill us all first, but provided we get to the end of this hour, the United States alone will have burned 15 million gallons of gasoline, 1 hour. And that turns out to be 350 million gallons per day. That's the amount of gasoline we use, another about 160 million gallons of diesel fuel. And the supply chain to provide this is pretty incredible. I mean, I'm working on projects in the background that hope to eliminate that and replace it with hydrogen, which is a big order. It's not something that's going to happen overnight. And there's electric car companies. The Tesla car company is moving into hydrogen. Tesla with Elon Musk moving into hydrogen. But there are limitations based on just well, limitations of resources, and not so much hydrogen being a limited resource. It's the most abundant element in the universe, and probably on Earth too, if you mix with water. Part of that H2O, there's two of them hooked onto an oxygen atom, and that's the molecule of water, and pretty much the entire surface of the Earth is covered with water. And up in the clouds, there's vast amounts. So anyway, lots of hydrogen around to be had, and all we have to do is convert that water into hydrogen, and then when it burns back, when it burns, so to speak, you get water, and so you recycle the water. And this is something that I realized in my studies of using hydrogen, is that we will have to recycle water. Now, this is a very interesting concept. So you take a fuel, water, you split it using electrolysis. That's green hydrogen. That's the best way to do it. And someday we will be able to produce that quantity of hydrogen. It's about a kilogram of hydrogen for 1 gallon of gasoline. That's let's just round numbers. It is somebody who's really astute on these numbers would say, well, that's not correct. But anyway, just for the general public, that's good enough. 1 gallon of gasoline is equivalent, more or less, to the energy stored in 1 kilogram of hydrogen. So that would make about 350 million kilograms of hydrogen per day to replace gasoline. And so anyway, I'm not going to go through all these numbers right now, but it is a big order. If you look at the worldwide infrastructure for producing oil, which then is converted into gasoline, and it's mainly crude oil is broken down, it forms gasoline and then diesel fuel and then other things like kerosene and all of the other things we use. And then part of that coming off, they used to just burn this, but the natural gas that comes off of those oil rigs. Then they started bottling that and using it, and that turns out to be one of our biggest sources of energy. Real clean energy is natural gas, and burning it. And by the way, this came in. A listener called in and talked for a while, and they said there was some programs, I think National Public Radio to be specific, that were they were bad mouthing natural gas because it gave off methane. Well, methane is one of the gases in natural gas, and when you burn it, it's a very clean burning fuel. So the methane and everything else that's in natural gas is very clean burning, and then they split off some of that what you call propane. Propane is a element, or it's a molecule, I should say. And the way it looks in a 2D representation is, imagine the kitchen table or the dining room table with three carbon atoms, one in the middle, one on each end of the table. And then you have six chairs on one side of the table, you have six chairs on the other side of the table, and a chair at each end. The chairs are the hydrogen atoms, and the three carbon atoms are sitting on top of the table, one in the middle and one at each end of the table. So that's what a propane molecule looks like. So they can split that, or they can refine that out of natural gas, and that gets pressurized then. And that's a whole industry in itself. If you live out in the country, chances are you have a propane tank sitting out in the backyard, and it's a gas in its natural state, and then it's pressurized into a liquid form for transportation and use. And when it you open up the valve, the propane comes flowing out the little tube. In that state, what's going on is it's boiling off the top in the gas form and going through the tube in a gas form, and to deliver to your stove or the kitchen, or maybe you have a backup generator that runs off of propane. Okay, so enough of that, but just started out with the comment that in the hour that I do this show tonight, 15 million gallons of gasoline will have been consumed by the United States alone. That doesn't include the whole rest of the planet. Okay, but this brings up another subject. Now, a number of years ago, well, let's go back to about 2016. I joined an XPRIZE, and I was a finalist. It was the Water Abundance XPRIZE. And I'm not going to talk about that, but it's just to give a perspective, I know a little bit about XPRIZEs. I've been a finalist. I've been to the big powwow, the out in San Diego where they award the prizes. I was, invited to the sit around with all the people that contribute to the XPRIZE, and have my picture taken with the head of the whole program, etc. But anyway, a couple years ago, a guy named Elon Musk started an XPRIZE with $400 million donation for the removal of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. And being in that business of, having the wind generator and everything, and having been involved in an XPRIZE and knowing the ropes, so to speak, and the way, anyway, the competition was for somebody to remove, and this would be given all costs of the cost of the equipment and everything. And there were cost objectives to remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, and with the goal, of course, to prevent global warming and yada yada, the routine. And so, anyway, I joined this XPRIZE with a project to, and the biggest thing I wanted was not necessarily to win the XPRIZE, but I wanted to see all of the different solutions that would be offered by the public for removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. And then the other part of this was you had to sequester the carbon dioxide and keep it out of the atmosphere permanently, or for at least 100 years. And that was the goal. And so the idea would be to bring us back, the goal, as I understand it, was to bring us back to the 1880s before the Industrial Revolution, at the time when we started burning oxygen and creating CO2. Because part of the issue here is, and I've talked about this previously on my show, that the idea that the Amazon rainforest is somehow regenerating oxygen into the atmosphere is ludicrous. I mean, sure, there's some generation, but basically, we're using native oxygen to breathe, us people, cows, squirrels, your car going down the road, oxygen-breathing vehicles, that burn kerosene or diesel fuel or coal, the old coal trains, or the or the gasoline automobile engines, etc., all are burning oxygen. And believe me, the little old rainforest down there in Amazon is not going to be enough to reproduce this oxygen. But the Earth has a vast, vast amount of oxygen, but it's being depleted at a small rate. You have to understand that about 20% of the Earth's atmosphere is in oxygen, in the form of oxygen, and the carbon dioxide is only 0.04%, just 10,000, a factor of 10,000 different. And so even if you could take and convert all of the CO2 in the atmosphere back to oxygen, get rid of all the CO2, it's not going to be a good thing, because plants need CO2 to breathe, just like you need oxygen. Now, imagine this is flipped around. Imagine that the Earth's atmosphere was 20% CO2, and there was only 0.04% oxygen. We'd be in a big, we'd be hurting. Let's just put it that way. The animals, the fish, the people, the squirrels, the elephants, the tigers, the buffalo, and everything on Earth would be really hurting, because there would not be enough oxygen if these tables were turned, if they were reversed. I never hear anybody talking about that. But the bottom line is that really, and experiments have been done, this is very clear, if you take a greenhouse at normal conditions, normal oxygen and CO2 levels, the, you know, plants will grow to a certain degree. If you double that CO2 content, which we're never going to do on planet Earth, no matter how much we burn the so-called fossil fuels or whatever, we're never going to double the CO2 content of Earth. But even doubling it would not make a dent in the amount of oxygen on the planet. It just wouldn't. I mean, it'd be 0.04 to 0.08%, and the amount of oxygen would be pretty much the same. I mean, would it change by 20% minus 0.04? No. And so really, the whole issue of this idea of carbon dioxide being a greenhouse gas is ludicrous. It's absolutely false. And there's many, many reasons, and I've talked about this, I've given entire lectures on this, is because the analogy sounds good, like it's a greenhouse, like the, oh, it's trapping the energy here. You know what the difference between carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and a greenhouse is? The greenhouse has a glass roof. Carbon dioxide is not a glass solid roof that prevents heat waves from going upwards. And it turns out that in you, when you burn, you know, oxygen, or let's say when you drive your car down the road, or burn coal to power a big ship or whatever, the amount of heat produced is thousands and thousands of times more than any greenhouse effect as a result of CO2 in the atmosphere. The direct heating of the atmosphere is immense, and the Earth dispels this every night. The Earth dispels all of this heat that's created, and nobody talks about that. That's why the CO2 argument is such a, it's just bad science. And I could go on and on. Those are just the first onion layers, and you don't have to go any farther than that to say, hey, this thing is bogus. But it's a political football, and that's what it's used for. Mainly to control water, by the way. But anyway, I joined the XPRIZE primarily to understand what are people thinking, what are they doing, what are the proposals for removing removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. But not only, not so much that, because sure, people will come up with innovative ideas. I had my own, and I made estimates that I could very easily remove the amount of CO2 that they were talking about in the Musk XPRIZE very, very easily. And so other people came up with other ideas. But the here's the point. We could easily remove way too much CO2. Once you start this process of removing CO2, It can go too far, and you could not bring it back. The other issue is the plants need CO2, and if the plants thrive and double in numbers and in mass and biomass and quantity, then the amount of oxygen being produced is going to be similarly large, because they're breathing this CO2 and contributing oxygen back into the system. But anyway, so there's a rationale, and here's, by the way, another thing. Let's look at back at when the mastodons were roaming the earth. These were huge, huge animals who consumed vast amounts of foliage. There's not a single place on planet Earth today that would support even a single mastodon, because there's not enough growth. It's so the whole point here is that when the mastodons roamed the Earth, there had to have been a very high percentage of CO2 in the atmosphere. That's just the only way you can cut it. And so instead of removing CO2, we should be liberating it from the ocean. We should be finding ways to concentrate CO2 into areas like, say, the Amazon jungle. Let's take an example here. You're in New York City right now, or you're in up north somewhere, Canada, and it's winter time. All the trees are brown. Remember the Simon and Garfunkel song? All the trees are brown. Was that Mamas and the Papas? I forget. One of those, a rock group anyway, from maybe the 60s. All the leaves are brown and the sky is gray. Okay. Yeah, that was a Mamas and the Papas song. And so, and which was interesting because I think it was called California Dreamin'. And it was written when they were up in the, I think it was Minneapolis. And the guy was walking down the street, and he was so cold, he walked into a church to get warm. And he was just sitting there shivering, and the priest was didn't lock the door so he could sit in there and then leave, because he could. But anyway, it's called California Dreamin', and that's why the song was written. But anyway, back to the idea of brown, all of the leaves are brown and the sky is gray. There's nothing. There's no plant life at all for 8 months of the year. Starting around September, the leaves start to dry out. By October, they're brown and orange and yellow, beautiful colors, and they fall off the trees. And then it waits until about April or maybe May, and then the little buds start coming out of the trees. And it's probably June until you actually have leaves on the trees or grass growing that you can mow or whatever. And so, really, about 8 months of the year, nothing's growing through the vast majority of planet Earth. The majority of land on planet Earth is in the northern hemisphere, as well as the population of the Earth. It's all breathing this air. So the majority of the 7 billion or 8 billion people on planet Earth live in the northern hemisphere. And during the winter, in that September to June time frame, to September to May time frame, there's no oxygen being produced there by the plants. Not a bit of oxygen being produced by the plants. So where does this air come from? How does the air being produced by the Amazon jungle get up to you? You breathe it, and then that carbon dioxide that you're breathing out magically goes back down to the Amazon jungle, gets recycled, and comes back up? No, that is ludicrous. Whoever is pushing these narratives, and the trouble with science today is it's emotional science. And I've talked about this before. But anyway, back to the XPRIZE, which is still going on, and I dropped out of it. I dropped out because I could spend a lot of time and money and effort, etc., producing a system that would remove oxygen, I'm sorry, remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. However, no, it's not something that I want to do. It's not a good idea. Removing CO2 from the atmosphere is a bad idea. And it can have bad results because you're taking away a very essential gas that plants need to grow. And if we don't have plants, we don't have animals, we don't have food, whether you're veg, especially if you're a vegetarian. Wow, what are you going to eat? And most vegetarians are out there thumping the drum that we got to remove CO2 or we can't produce more CO2. No. We should not be burning oil and gasoline and propane and all these fuels at the rate we're burning them, 15 million gallons in the time I do this show. We should not be burning that because we shouldn't be burning it. This excessive amount of energy just to drive up and down the road every day to get to work or to drive and get groceries or whatever you do, we shouldn't be doing that because it pollutes. You know, and the immense infrastructure and all the pollution that comes with refining and moving oil, not to mention the wars that it causes. We shouldn't be doing that for direct reasons, not these ulterior motive reasons like the greenhouse deal, which is bogus science. The world is filled with incorrect reasons for not doing things, and you know what? They don't work. Ask yourself. Since the last 20 to 30 years, when the real push for bottling up greenhouse emissions has started, have we used less energy? And the answer is no. We use more today than ever. So it's a you know it's a carrot in front of the horse, driving things, and it's just used as a political football to control the public. That's all it is. It doesn't work. It hasn't prevented us from using more energy. In fact, we use more energy. That's the real litmus test of whether it's worth anything or not. All of the effort and all the crying and wailing and gnashing of teeth about the greenhouse gases. The bottom line is, has it worked? And the answer is no. You stop wasting your time. Stop wasting everybody else's time. But the main point I want to bring up about the Musk XPRIZE, which I dropped out of, I just in fact. Recently, and that's why I'm talking about it now. I haven't really talked about this since I joined like quite a year and a half ago. The main point is that yes, we can take CO2 out of the atmosphere. Yes, we can take a lot of it, and that's one of the challenges with an XPRIZE is to do something that's really impossible today to do it and to do it efficiently. And at an extremely low cost. And that was what was going on with the Water Abundance XPRIZE, in which I was a finalist, as to bring in technologies, which I did. I brought in the wing generator technology and then my water from the air machines as the solution and made it all the way to the finals of that out of 98 international teams. So that's what it's all about, to do something. And so back to the Musk XPRIZE to remove CO2 from the atmosphere. Yes, companies can do this. Yes, they can take out tremendous amounts of CO2 out of the atmosphere. And finally, yes, they can overdo it. And how do you get these things to stop once they've started? In a lot of cases, they are natural systems that you would begin, and that was the case with mine. Once the system began, the one that I had, I'm not going to go into detail what the solution was, but once it began, it was self-propagating. It would continue to grow and grow and grow with time, and so it would become much bigger. And so the whole issue there is that now you're taking a lot of CO2 out of the atmosphere to grow stuff that you want to sequester that CO2, so you don't want to. If it's trees or biomass, you don't want to cut it down, and you want it to continue to live, so that CO2 is contained. That's part of the XPRIZE, is to sequester it and keep it there. So you're taking CO2 out of the atmosphere, removing it permanently, and it's really bad for the plant life. And we would be much better off if we had very much higher. We could double or triple or quadruple or multiply 10 times the amount of CO2 in the Earth's atmosphere, and it would be the biggest benefit to mankind that you ever saw. and it would not heat up the planet. The whole idea that it's heating up the planet is fairy tale science, started by none other than my arch enemy, Carl Sagan. What a clown. What a clown. Carl Sagan the clown. With the billions and billions. You know, everything he did, and I have a whole resume of in my education set of courses dealing with the Cosmos series, which was Carl Sagan's expose of modern science. And everybody else has followed that to the T ever since. And one of the things he developed as a scientist, he was the first one to push the greenhouse effect. And where did it come from? It came from the fact that when the original estimates of Venus were that it was like a very clouded planet, probably rained a lot. They expected to find dinosaurs there, rainforests, tropical rainforests, etc. They get to Venus, and it's like smoking hot. It's so hot it could melt lead. It rains sulfuric acid, not water, but sulfuric acid out of the clouds. And it's got a CO2 atmosphere that is 2,000 times bigger than the entire atmosphere of Earth. So Carl perks up and he goes, it's the greenhouse effect. Well, as soon as the words were not even out of his mouth, when scientists correctly criticized him, saying, well, the temperature on the dark side of Venus, which is dark for a very long period of time, the temperature is the same as on the sunward side of Venus. So how does the heat get around there? Because there's no wind on Venus. There are no wind patterns at the ground level. So how does the heat get from the sunny side to the non-sunny side? Well, it doesn't happen. There's no way to do that. Then the laundry list of arguments against Venus having a greenhouse effect for its high temperature just grew and grew and grew. And the real reason Venus has a high temperature is it's simply a new planet. Simple. That's what it is. And so anyway, then before the ink was dry in the paper, they said, well, Earth has CO2 in its atmosphere. Maybe we could have a greenhouse effect here. And this has actually happened, that in discussing the greenhouse effect relative to Venus, they realized it didn't work. And so the Carl Sagan and company comes back and says, well, now we have the exaggerated greenhouse effect. And that's literally the term they used, the exaggerated greenhouse effect. And said, well, now it's exaggerated, so it's amplified, and so you can't criticize it because it's exaggerated. So anyway, and then they came up with the idea that, well, maybe it can work on planet Earth. And that's where it all began. That was the seed that spawned this whole thing. And, of course, Carl was a Tier 2 scientist. I mean, the classic sense of a Tier 2 scientist, Carl Sagan, would never met a real Tier 1 scientist in his life. And was a very poor scientist in terms, and even his peers considered him not a very good scientist. Most of his 300 and some published papers were work that was done by his graduate students. And the reason I know that is because his secretary, Marie Jones, typed my books when I was at Cornell. She told me she typed their papers, and they complained about Carl taking their papers and publishing them under his name. Anyway, you know, a little bit of history there. Getting back to the XPRIZE, the Musk XPRIZE, no, we should not be taking CO2 out of the atmosphere in any quantity. The more CO2, the better. However, it's not a good idea to put it there by way of burning fossil fuels. And the fossil fuels is a misnomer, because oil and gasoline and all the derivatives were not the result of dinosaur bones and fern forests. So, at any rate, okay, well, enough of that, but just wanted to air that publicly, that that I was in that program, that prize, and left it on purpose, because, and it was interesting to see the different techniques that people came up with to sequester, making, you know, making tennis shoes, putting it in cement. all kinds of other things. Anyway, yeah, a lot of creativity there. And I don't know if what will actually happen, but if Elon really is sincere about this, he should cancel it and say, look, this was a mistake. But once you get all these people doing this, it's like anything else. How do you stop it? Quick note here, Amelia Earhart lost plane found. This was in the news this past week, and some people took sonar radar into that region out in the Pacific Ocean, and they covered a like 5,000 square mile area with sonar and came up with an image of what appears to be an airplane sitting on the bottom of the ocean, way down there. It's like a mile down or something. And so anyway, now they're going to go back with submersibles and go down and see if in fact that is her plane. But when I looked at the image, it appeared to be a swept wing aircraft in their image. But I mean, maybe it's not an aircraft, maybe it's something else, some natural formation, who knows? But it could be an airplane, but it looked like a swept wing, the kind that not a modern swept wing aircraft, but more like that Korean War vintage swept wing aircraft that the US military had at those times. This following is an interesting story talking about submersibles. That the remember the submersible was going down to the Titanic, which by the way may not be the Titanic. It might be the sister ship that's actually down there. And they changed the names, remember, on the ships for insurance purposes and that whole story. And the owner of the ship, J.P. Morgan, and some other guys were just happened to cancel their trip at the very last minute, and all their competition, the Astors and the other families that were their competition, happened to meet their early demise on the Titanic or whatever ship that was. So anyway, this submersible is going down to examine the Titanic, and one of the things they want to do is start bringing things up, like artifacts. And there's some controversy over this. But anyway, this submersible goes down, and they said the Navy reported almost immediately that there was a collapse. This thing collapsed because of compression, because of the tremendous pressure of water down there, and everybody died. But somebody then went down with another submersible to check out the submersible that went down there to view the Titanic. And what they realized was that it did not fail because of compression, that it was had all kinds of hack marks on it, like it got like sabotaged, let's just put it that way. In the article, they talked about some kind of sea monster eating it. Well, that's pretty weird. I don't know too many people who would buy that one. But is there a reason why somebody wanted to sabotage that? And who would be able to do that other than the U.S. Navy, which gets full circle, brings us back to what was the U.S. Navy doing out there in the first place, and how come they could state just right after this accident or whatever it was, how could they state that in fact this was a compression? They heard the sound, the kind of an implosion sound, I guess, and stated that it was due to compression, a compression failure. But the designer of the ship said, no, there's no way that ship failed because of compression. It wasn't deep enough to have any issues like that. It was built for much deeper, much deeper in the ocean where it fit than where it failed. Anyway, I'm just bringing this up because it's a story that's in the news. It's one of those developing things, that one of those developing stories where we'll keep an eye on that and see where it goes. Just a quick note here on AI, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this show, but around May of this year, and this is the reason I say this is because of the upcoming election. They have to do something to control it. There's all kinds of other indicators in the wind that are suggesting that there's going to be some kind of pandemic happening in May of this year. But it's going to be allianced with some kind of AI catastrophe, some kind of hacking of the internet, of banks, of something else. And other people are saying this also. I've been saying this for a while, but the timing is such that it would disrupt the November election, to which they desperately have to control. Okay, so anyway, I'm just going to mention that I'll go on to my main science topic here. This past week, Arno Penzias was the guy who won the Nobel Prize 1978 in physics. And this was because him and Robert Wilson, his sidekick, built a microwave antenna in their backyard. And when they scanned the heavens for microwaves, they found this hissing noise that was everywhere. And no matter where they point their antenna, they would find this hissing noise. And they realized that it was coming from outer space. Was later confirmed by other methods, but basically, low energy microwave background noise, you would call it, from coming from all directions in outer space. So they theorized, and now this had been theorized previously, that there was because of the Big Bang, and of course the Big Bang concept had been around since the beginning of the 1900s, starting with a guy named Edwin Hubble. And the Eddington experiment with the so-called proving general relativity, all of this came together at the very early part of the 20th century, the early 1900s. And so in the 1970s time frame, Arno Penzias and Robert Wilson then provide the confirming evidence, well, allegedly, that the Big Bang happened, and this residual noise from the Big Bang was so-called discovered. But the problem is, as with many theoretical measurements and confirmations, they didn't confirm, or they didn't anticipate, let's put it that way, because it's hard to anticipate. You only can work with information that's available in front of you at the time. They didn't anticipate that somebody would come along like myself and find a totally different explanation. And as it turns out, and of course, actually they had data at the time which would suggest that it was not due to cosmos-filled residual from a Big Bang. What they really are measuring, and this is something I discovered and have published, actually, and of course, nobody in the scientific world is going to give any credence to anything that goes against a Nobel Prize winning discovery, which was given incorrectly. Now, I've talked about this before. In my 2022 shows, I gave quite an extensive series of lectures on Nobel Prizes and the bogus Nobel Prizes, especially recent ones. And so anyway, this is one of the bogus, I would call bogus in retrospect. I'm sure they were trying to do a good job at the time. But in retrospect, this is a Nobel Prize which has really damaged science. Because once these things are locked in place, it's like nobody can, you know, say that the king has no clothes. And that's why I'm an independent scientist. I don't have anything to lose by telling the truth or what my vision of this. What they were really looking at was the nebular ion cloud. And this is something that it was something that I made public when I was at Cornell, really like the year after this Nobel Prize was given, that the solar system, our solar system, and many other star systems are surrounded by a nebular ion cloud. And this ion cloud is held back by solar wind pressure. And it would only make sense that it's sweeping out material in the solar system. and holding it back. And you can see these rings of clouds of material around other stars. Our neighboring stars all have them. And not only that, but you can train a microwave telescope on these cloud systems and measure the same background radiation. And so, anyway, what they are seeing, and there's no question in my mind, what they are seeing is the microwave. It's a 3 degrees temperature, so it's very cold. It's just the black body heat temperature signature from a cloud of dust and gas that surrounds our solar system. Very simply, that's what it is. And so there's many other reasons for believing or understanding that the Big Bang did not happen. One is, remember the redshift. And this is something, because I study science, I not only study science, but the history of science, and where did these theories come from? Who made them up? Who, let's take another one that's not related to the Big Bang. The Oort cloud. What is the guy's name? Christian Oort? Was that his first name, Christian? Anyway, he's a, I think, a Danish guy, a physicist, astronomer, and they're noticing these comets coming in the solar system. And of course, what do? They calculate the orbits of the comets. And the long period comets, these are the ones that come from way, way out there. They plot the outside end of their orbit. And they all seem to be around this one region that surrounds our solar system, coming in out in all directions, basically. And they all seem to be coming from this region. Their elliptical orbits are closed, and they would only and the farthest they got away was out in this kind of region. So he hypothesized that there was this big cloud of comets out there. And that every now and then some object would pass through and disrupt them and send some hurtling all over the place, and some would end up in our solar system as comets. And these were snowballs, and of course they were believed to be dirty snowballs, or back in the Oort days would be ice ball. The ice ball comet model was what it was called back in the 50s when Hubble, or when, I'm sorry, when Fred Whipple canonized it, regurgitated it, revamped it, rehomogenized it for the public in the aftermath of the Velikovsky affair. And they had to come up with some kind of explanation for what comets were. So anyway, that stuck. They threw some mud on the wall. That stuck. But at any rate, the very interesting piece of physics by Oort showing that the limit, not all comets, but the vast majority, had it right around that same region, coming from all different directions. And so they hypothesized what they called the Oort cloud. Well, that's kind of like the Big Bang hypothesis with Arnaud Penzias. It really fit the data, it made sense, but how are you going to ever prove this? Because with the case of the microwave antenna that Penzias and Wilson built, well, first of all, you'd probably think you better get it out of our atmosphere, and then you better get it out of our solar system to make sure that it's not due to this cloud that surrounds our solar system. But they didn't even know about that. If they would have, maybe, oh, excuse me, maybe they would have thought twice about publishing the results. But of course, like many things, it was heralded into place. But the getting back to the idea of the redshift. The other big pillar that the Big Bang theory sits on is that when Edwin Hubble was the first guy to have good equipment, good telescopes, he attached spectrometers, started measuring the spectrum of stars and galaxies, etc. And what he realized is that everything out there had a redshift. Well, the only known cause of redshift at the time was special relativity, the idea that things were moving away from us, so therefore the light was shifted to the red in the spectrum. Therefore, everything must be moving away from us. Therefore, we're in an expanding universe, and if you reverse that, then you would come back to a point, allegedly a single point in the universe where everything began. And of course, that's a stretch of the theoretical imagination ad infinitum, because To imagine that just because stuff's moving away, if you reverse that, it all came back to one point, is a pretty wild stretch of the imagination. But they did it, and they got away with it. And then this Big Bang thing stuck. And then, so that's back at the beginning of the 1900s, the beginning of the 20th century. And then they add to that the Eddington experiment, which allegedly showed that light was bending around the gravitational well of the sun, when in fact the real cause of that was the electric fields. That's one of the other theoretical concepts I came up with when I was at Cornell, realizing that it was the non-uniform electric field of the sun that was causing the redshift, not the gravitational well. And so anyway, a lot of problems with general relativity, including the famous elevator example, or the Gedanken experiment, or what is also known as the principle of equivalence, has never been proven. These are thought experiments. They are Gedanken experiments. Gedanken is the German word for thought experiments. And so the entire concept of the Big Bang rests on interpretation of data, is the point. And of course, once it gets voted into place, you can't change it. It's kind of like the greenhouse effect and causing global warming. Once it's in place, once it's in the public mindset, how do you change it? Everybody's hooked into that. Whether it's true or not, doesn't matter. Everybody is locked into that mindset, and that's the way it is. So anyway, this past week, Arno Penzias, I believe he must have been in his 90s, passes away. And so there's a great deal of reverberation about the Big Bang and the 1978 Nobel Prize in Physics. And of course, I was a student at the time. I got my bachelor's degree in double major physics mathematics, 1970. And so this was, in fact, I personally was teaching in a foreign country, physics, mathematics at the university level, and computer science. That's what I was doing at the time. But, you know, much earlier than all of this time, I was developing my theoretical work, which came to fruition when I was at Cornell in 1979. Just to give you a time frame for what I was doing during this epoch. And so it wasn't until those Cornell years, 79 to 81, that I was really developing all the counter-theoretical work, you might call it. The induced electric dipole redshift, which explained that the redshifts were not due to things moving away. It was just a local condition, non-uniform electric fields around star systems with fusion-based atmospheres. That's the cause of the redshift, not the expanding universe. And then the microwave background radiation of Penzias and Wilson was not due to the residual from a Big Bang, but it was simply a dust cloud that surrounds our solar system, which, by the way, just happens to be one of the sources of material for forming planets out in the Kuiper Belt. That's where the Kuiper Belt planets are forming, is out in that dust cloud by way of comets that are discharging the capacitor. And you can see those comets forming around other solar systems, around other nearby stars. You can see the nebular ion cloud and the comets forming and picking up material and forming planets. And that's why we have thousands and thousands of planets out in the Kuiper region, because that's where they're forming. So as you can see, when I do theoretical work, I don't just concentrate on one little teeny weeny piece of the pie. It has to be coordinated into all the different aspects of what's going on in the solar system and in the universe, basically. I briefly mentioned the Eddington experiment, where he went to an island with a telescope, and during a total eclipse of the sun, first of all, took pictures of that part of the sky, and then when he went with the same telescope to the the tropics for the total eclipse of the sun, took a picture of the same region of the sky, but with the moon in front of the sun, the moon blocking out the light from the sun. And supposedly, all of the stars bounced outwards a little bit, proving general relativity that light is bending around the sun. Well, actually, what happened is he cherry-picked the data. If you look at the data, the actual full data set of Eddington, the movement of the stars is all over the place, and they're varying sizes. The farther away you get from the sun, the less the change should be. And that's not what happened. In a lot of cases, the farther away you got from the sun, the bigger the change. So basically, he picked about a half a dozen points out of this database of these photos, claimed that they supported general relativity, and since very few people on the planet could even look at the data, let alone understand it, this was railroaded into prominence, and that's the end of the story. So that was another major piece of the foundation of the Big Bang Theory, is general relativity, because then you get into the idea of black holes, expansion, you know, all of these different concepts, which are essential pieces of the pie of the Big Bang Theory. Now, in the early 1990s, and actually late 1980s, there was a satellite that was put up. It was called the COBE satellite, C-O-B-E, and it was a microwave telescope that was put into orbit. And the purpose was to confirm the consistency of this aura of microwave background radiation. And it was allegedly supposed to be very pure, very consistent, because after 3 billion years with any black body type of radiation, which this was a remnant of black body radiation from the explosion, it should have been very uniform, very even across all of the outer space. Because it had, what, 10 billion years or more to spread out and neutralize any inconsistencies. In other words, it should be very smooth. So the COBE satellite gets up there and immediately shows inconsistencies that are not expected. So the Big Bang theorists go running back to the drawing board, and they come up with string theory and bubble theory and all these other theories. And of course, all you got to do is give somebody the idea that, okay, well, it's not really so even as before, and they'll come up with 20 ways to Sunday as to why it should be that way and still consistent with the Big Bang. So that happened. Then there was another satellite that was sent up, which was even more detailed. And as I recall, that even showed movement in the splotches of microwave radiation measured from outer space. And they even moved. They were actually mobile, which should have put the final nail in the coffin for the Big Bang Theory right there. But as with all bad science, they sweep that under the rug and find a way to make it consistent and then go back to normal. Because the major theory, you cannot question. The Big Bang Theory is not something that is allowed to be discussed in a negative tone. It can only be praised because all of the, it's like a football team. When everybody's blocking to the right, the whole team's going to go to the right. And so, Big Bang Theory lives on in spite of the fact that one of its authors, Arnaud Penzias, has passed away. And, you know, these people are good people. I'm not criticizing in that respect. However, it really, what bothers me, being an independent scientist, is the kind of like the cloistering of knowledge, where, since it's impossible to question these things, how does anything ever get resolved? And it doesn't. So you have 100 years, literally more than 100 years of really bad science being at the forefront and being praised when there's not an ounce of it true at all. It's completely fabricated, incorrect science. And the Big Bang is probably highest on the totem pole. If you had the totem pole of all of the false theoretical work, the greenhouse effect at Venus, you have the plate tectonics that supposedly, allegedly, slow moving plates form mountains and whatever. You know, if you had the totem pole of all the incorrect theories on the planet, the Big Bang would really be the top one. That'd be the one way up there at the tippity top that caused the most damage, that caused the most allegiance to something that absolutely has no validity at all. I just wanted to bring up one last little point here, which is somewhat comical. And even the public, even humorous cartoonists are starting to notice this, where everything is a Big Bang. As you got, I'm sorry, a black hole. There's all kinds of mini black holes out there. There's one in your suitcase. There's one down the street. There's one rolling down the block in front of your house. And this is being picked up by humorists, which I like it because it's one way of me knowing that the general public isn't buying all of this. It's just to, you know, for example, how do you take a picture of a black hole? A black hole, by definition, sucks in all light and it can't get out. So the most you're going to take a picture of is a space in the outer space that has nothing coming from it. Yet whole teams of scientists have claimed to have taken pictures of a black hole. How does that work? Well, in today's world of modern science, almost anything is possible. So anyway, leave you with that, a little bit of a lighter note, that the public, the general public out there, is waking up and also having a little bit of a chuckle over it. Just a minute here left in this show. I want to talk about my water filters. Tonight I'll be on with Jeff Rentz in a couple hours, 9 o'clock Central Time. Guest, I'm always a guest with Jeff the first Thursday of the month. And I'll be announcing a super sale on the water filters, my MR5 Best Deal, which is the MR5 Whole House Water Filter, the ultraviolet sterilizer, and the extra pack of filter elements for the MR5. We call it the Best Deal. Typically, $23.80 is the price. $13.80, literally $1,000 off. And so that is on the webpage, jmccwaterfilters.com. And go there, make use of that, get yourself a whole house water filter at this unbelievably low price. And also we have the gravity water filters there for the Berkey-style water filters. They're not on sale. They're never on sale. But at any rate, go to the webpage, jmccwaterfilters.com. And I'm out of time. We'll talk to you next week. This is James McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.